Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Understanding the cosmos through modern physics can be rough. Relativity and quantum mechanics don't come easy. Never mind string theory. What's a layperson who wants to understand to do? One solution, think it through yourself. More than a few non-scientists are coming up with their own big ideas about how the universe is put together. Is this useful, nutty, brave? And what does it say about our relationship with science? This hour on Point, we're looking at the story of physics on the fringe. You can join the conversation. Have you given up on getting it? The science of everything, the cosmos, have you worked it out for yourself? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll talk with the author of How the Hippies Saved Physics. But joining me now from Pasadena, California, is Margaret Wertheim, award-winning science writer and student of physics and mathematics. Her new book is Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Zirklons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. She's also co-founder of the Institute for Figuring, an L.A.-based organization devoted to educating the public about the aesthetic dimensions of science and math. The Institute has worked on projects like a vast crocheted coral reef and a giant three-dimensional fractal constructed out of business cards. Margaret Wertheim, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Lovely to be here, Tom.
I had no idea how trapped I was going to get by your book and this line of inquiry. I thought, oh, a bunch of wacky, nutty ideas. You know, everybody's got some. Who needs it? But you've led me in here and brought me to a perspective that I didn't expect to get. It might help us just to get a sense of how you began to come. And here you are. You studied physics and math. You didn't need sort of, you know, physics on the fringe to tell you which way the wind was blowing. And yet you got caught up with some of these characters. Jim Carter in particular. Introduce us to this man.
Well, Jim is what I call the Leonardo of outsider physicists. He has no training in science beyond high school. And he's lived a life being a gold miner and an abalone diver. And he now runs a trailer park in Enumclaw, Washington State. That's about an hour south of Seattle. Mm. But he spent the last 50 years of his life developing his own alternative theory of physics. And he believes he has a complete theory, one that explains everything from gravity to the structure of matter to the nature of space and time and ultimately the coming into being of the universe. So to Jim himself, he believes that he has done what physicists for the past century have been desperately aiming to do, which is to find a complete theory of everything, one that would unify our picture of the cosmos, which is generally said to be by relativity, and one that would unify our theory of the very small, which we usually articulate through quantum mechanics. Now, Jim's theory is completely different from either relativity or quantum mechanics,
yep.
And he's been doing this all in his own backyard. He does things like make giant smoke rings to test his ideas about subatomic particles.
So if we can hold it right there for just a moment. I mean, people are going to be scratching their heads already. He's making giant smoke rings in the backyard of his trailer, in the trailer court he's got there on the Green River Gorge. You went out to visit him. He's got a yard full of old Chryslers and Cadillacs rusting in picturesque heaps. You remind us, a pet swan, a couple of dogs, his family there. Does he have a PhD? Has he studied physics in university?
No, Jim did not do any higher degrees. He went to college for one term after high school and he realized it wasn't for him. As he put it, you know, he wanted to learn the secrets of the universe, and in university they were going to put you through courses like pre-calculus and algebra and, you know, physics 101, where you do boring things like rolling balls down inclined planes. And he wanted to engage with, you know, the major questions of reality right there and then. So he left university after one term and actually went off to search for a meteorite, which he thought would be more useful to science than sitting around reading books.
But here you are with a science background. You've written about all kinds of science. You go out to this trailer court, meet this guy with his own idea he's come up with whole cloth about the cosmos, and you say that it's turned into one of the strangest and most challenging relationships of your life, and you've seen quite a bit. Why so challenging?
Well, when I encountered Jim, my first thought, like a lot of people who hear about this subject, is, oh, he'll, you know, with any luck, he'll be an amusing loony.
Yeah.
And perhaps he'll be the subject for an article. But what I realised when I met Jim and as I came to know him is that he had a really quite extraordinary life, that his do-it-yourself approach to cosmology and to physics in general was really part of a do-it-yourself life on every level. So Jim doesn't have a degree in building or architecture, yet he designed and built his own house, which is an extraordinary construction on the top of this gorge, which has got grass on, growing on the roof and a tree growing through the middle of it. It's a sort of hobbitesque, you know, Middle-earth fantasy, and it's very quirky, but, you know, it holds up and it's his style and it's great. Jim doesn't have a degree in engineering, yet he has a successful business based on an invention that he designed called lift bags, which is a very simple thing. If you have a boat that's sunk, you're required by international law to lift it up. Mm-hmm. And Jim simply designed these bags that you take them under the water, you fill them with air from a scuba tank, and the bag fills up.
Balloons
and presto,
up.
It lifts it lifts the boat to the surface of the water. Mm. Very simple invention based on Archimedes' principles. He was the first person to put them on the market, and he has this very successful business selling these things all around the world to people like the Coast Guard and the US Navy. So, you know, here he is, no degrees in anything, doing everything that he wants to do, building his house, building his trailer park, building his engineering company,
and coming up from
his
that
own
little
theory with the universe.
Yes, theory of how everything works. And then what really struck me was, Margaret, once I got into reading about his view of things, is that it's got some legs. I've actually heard it before. I mean, one of his big bottom lines is that gravity does not exist. And I wish you'd explain to us how he accounts for what we perceive then as gravity. But as I read how he thinks about it, I realized that a terrific friend of mine in California who does have a PhD had actually come to me with this theory once. And I don't know if it's Jim Carter's, but it's got currency out there. What does Jim Carter think? He says gravity doesn't exist. So what's going on when the ball falls to the floor?
Well, in Jim's physics, there's no such thing as it were, a separate force of gravity. What's causing the thing that we experience as gravity, according to him, is that matter is expanding. So all matter is constantly getting bigger in size. And if you apply that to the Earth, it means, you know, the huge ball of matter that we call the Earth is constantly moving out from its center, and therefore it's pushing against our feet. Mm-hmm. So it's really, the fact that we feel rooted to the ground is because there's this constant pressure pushing upwards like a balloon expanding
against our feet. We're in a perpetual explosion and everything's pushing us out. It feels like pushing us down.
Yes. So in Jim's theory, all matter is expanding every minute of every hour of every day. And it's this constant expansion that we experience as gravity. So that's the most radical part of Jim's theory. Even he acknowledges that that's a pretty wild idea to accept. There have been other ideas. Gravity remains one of the most controversial phenomena in physics, and we still don't really know ultimately what gravity is. You know, physicists who are trying to unify relativity and quantum mechanics are really debating this issue and have been for about 100 years. You know, Newton said gravity is this invisible force. Einstein came along with his theory of relativity and said, well, it's a curvature in the structure of space-time. But what, you know, that's obviously part of the answer, but we still don't understand the fullness of it. One of the things that a lot of people like Jim who are outsiders do is they reject these very sophisticated mathematical descriptions that mainstream physicists have. Mm-hmm. They reject the idea that you have to understand nature through these really arcane mathematical tools. And in fact, their claim, it's a very interesting claim, whether we believe it or not, it's an interesting claim, is that nature speaks a language that the common person can understand. So they're resisting the idea that you have to have a PhD in these high mathematical languages in order to understand the true nature of the world.
And you're now, saying we have to listen to that. This is important because ever since Copernicus kind of knocked us off the simple religious understanding of the cosmos, science has been stepping in to take the place of that. And if ordinary people want to understand the sort of map of reality, today they're asked to know high physics and string theory and quantum mechanics and all the rest. I mean, you can see how people might suffer what we call modern alienation if they can't understand the shape of their own cosmos, if it's presented to them by what can look like a priesthood of scientists as almost beyond them.
I think you put that extremely well, Tom, and that's really one of the great thing that led me to want to write this book. If it was just one individual in his trailer park dreaming up his own theory of the universe, you'd think, oh, well, you know, he just didn't have very good educational opportunities. But there are thousands of these people. They have their own association now called the Natural Philosophy Alliance, and you can go online and they have thousands of dissident theorists listed in their database. They have yearly conferences. They publish proceedings of their conference, which has hundreds of papers from these people.
But what if it's all crackpot? And what if it's all just nutty? Or is that, have you dropped that kind of sense of it?
Well, you know, this raised a very big question, Tom. What gets regarded as crackpot mm-hmm. and what gets regarded as legitimate? Now, I don't think that anything I've encountered through the NPA or any of the outsiders that I've met, I don't believe that any of it's ever going to be taught in Harvard or Princeton. I don't believe these people are going to win Nobel Prizes. But I think it's a phenomena worth taking seriously, one that we need to take seriously, because these people are, as it were, an index of some sort of failure of mainstream science to communicate itself to a wide range of people. And I think what's going on here is that these people love science, want to be involved in science, mm-hmm. but as you said earlier, they feel deeply alienated by the science they read about in magazines like Discover and Scientific American.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about extraordinary, ordinary people trying to figure out the cosmos on their own. Never mind Einstein and Copernicus. These people are on the case. Margaret Wertheim is with us, award-winning science writer, student of physics and math herself. Her new book is Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. She's the author of The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace and Pythagoras Trousers. Now she's out with people who are trying to figure it out on their own. Margaret Wertheim joins us from Pasadena, California. Margaret, here's a listener online, says, scientists should do a better job at bridging the gap. Otherwise, they become high priests and their subject matter becomes religion, which is rather ironic.
Yes, well, I think that is one of the things that we're sort of in danger of happening, that physicists, theoretical physicists, now speak this very arcane language, which very few people can understand, about one of the most fundamental questions in our society: what is the nature of reality? And one can make a comparison here to what happened in the Renaissance, when the Catholic Church priesthood were only delivering sermons in Latin, and the Bible was only available in Latin. And yet,
what if it is just that complex, Margaret? What if all that fancy math is simply the beginnings of the language of the universe? I mean, you remind us, Einstein said that, you know, the secrets of the universe should bring on a form of rapturous amazement. Well, if yes. you can understand them. Or, well, Stuart Kaufman, the great complexity theory pioneer in physics, saying scientists should help us feel more at home in the universe. But maybe understanding that home just requires a whole lot of math.
Well, I think there is a level on which the mathematics has to be taken on board. I mean, if you want to understand how to build a better microchip, you do have to understand the language of quantum mechanics, and we're all beneficiaries of that. You know, we sit here with our laptops and this wonderful screen I'm looking at in the radio
yes.
studio.
Mm-hmm.
That's all provided by wonderful computer technology that is a byproduct of 100 years of ever more detailed quantum mechanical understanding of semiconductors. So the mathematics is extremely important for making stuff work. The problem I think we face now is that if our mathematical understanding of the cosmos is so complex that most people can't understand it, then they don't get to feel at home in the universe science describes. They look at the universe science describes and they feel outside of it, a bit beyond it, a bit, you know, it's above me. And I think this is a difficult sociological question. What do we do with this situation? I don't think that we can abandon science at all in the way that we're doing it. Physics manifestly work. We've got laser chips. We've mm-hmm. got microchips and lasers. We're putting people on the moon because we do know all this great
and
physics.
GPS and all the
and
rest.
And GPS.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, this physics plays an incredibly important instrumental role in our lives, but we but one of the other goals of science is to help us to understand how we are, how we as humans fit into the wider cosmological scheme. This is what I call the cosmological problem. But we are now articulating a cosmos that's so complicated that most people can't even hope to understand it. I think part of the issue we have to address in why I'm interested in this subject is in part that it suggests to me that we just need to do a much better job of communicating science.
But take us to this fringe. I mean, the basic of science, as we've, the basis of it, as we've come to understand it, is that scientific insights can be tested and replicated. And here you've got people working outside of any system, by and large. They're loners, almost all men, you write. And they tend to be really on their own. So, I mean, can they really do science out there? Do you look at this as just a quixotic, out on the fringe or something with potential importance?
Well, I think that these people, as you say, Tom, they pretty much work on their own. And they have very little equipment, mostly. So they can't test very sophisticated ideas. They do put forward ideas that could be tested. But I don't think their experiments are likely to get accepted, say, at CERN or any of the big particle accelerators, which are peer-reviewed.
Are they wacky, like, you know, sort of, Scientology explanations of the world, volcanoes and giants on different planets?
These people have very quixotic theories about the nature of space and time and the nature of light and the fundamental structure of matter. So, you know, they have their alternative explanations of things like how the periodic table of elements are put together. And these things could be tested in particle accelerators. I'm pretty certain that any of the ideas that I've seen, were they to be tested in particle accelerators, they'd be proved wrong.
Urge to understand, to be at home in the universe, to understand the cosmos, than the actual science or speculation, we'll call it what you will, being produced here.
Yes. I mean, I don't think that any of these people that I've seen have actually come up with a theory that is going to stand the test of time and be taught at Harvard or Princeton. What I think is important here is the sociological phenomena. There are so many of these people. They represent something important about our society's relationship to science. And they're constantly growing in number and having these meetings and getting together and publishing books. And I think, in a way, what they are representing is something like creationism, but it's a reaction against what they see as the impenetrability and a bit alienating experience that they're being presented with through the mainstream science. But what's very different between these people and creationists is that they love science. They believe that science is the right way to tell us about the nature of reality, but they believe that science can tell us about the nature of reality in a way that ordinary people can comprehend. Now, that's a really interesting philosophical claim. Is it true? It's a really interesting sociological claim. And I think it's important for our society, as we, you know, talk about that, how can we get more people to be engaged with science, which is something that I think we need badly.
Margaret Wertheim, if I may, just to quote you here, Margaret writes, ever since Copernicus and his contemporaries in the 16th century replaced the Earth-centered, God-focused vision of the cosmos with a sun-centered view, the officially sanctioned picture of our universe has increasingly been dictated by astronomy and physics. But then the question she's raising is, what happens when people can't follow that? You flash forward just a little bit. You go to Francis Bacon, promising, she writes again, at the start of the 17th century, science can deliver a reasonable, functional, and satisfying description of reality. The claim that such a description ought to be comprehensible, the outsider's claim is that description ought to be comprehensible to all human beings. Maybe it should, maybe it shouldn't, but without it, there's a human hunger. Margaret Wertheim's new book is Physics on the Fringe. And, Margaret, we've got callers for you. Enrique in Boston. Hi, Enrique. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I just want to make a quick point. It may seem, at least for me, obvious that this type of science or field would need a person like Steve Jobs. You know, what he did for the computing industry, I think they do need an equivalent to this industry because, the complexity will just go up. Semiconductors will be more complex, the science will be more complex, software will be more complex, and everybody, you know, actually embraced all that complexity into one simple device, which is the iPad, and the other, you know, platform products that connect to each other seamlessly. And so it was, you know, there was this transformation of a very complex technology into very simple to use tools that everybody could actually use and interface with.
But can you do that with science itself, Enrique? Can you just, like Steve Jobs did, can you just make it beautiful somehow?
Well, I think it can be. It can be done because, you know, if people want to focus on kind of showing off how complex it is, that's one element. But if they focus on the end point, which is, hey, you know, just kind of understand where we are in the world and in the universe and how we kind of live and breathe and how other life forms could form, et cetera. But just focus on the end point and what is the point of doing all this search. I think that's where the beauty starts coming out.
And Enrique, you're rocking it. Let me put that to right to Margaret. Margaret, what about it? Is Steve Jobs for science? Is that possible?
Well, you know, I think it is, that's what some of these outsiders would claim that they're trying to do, is to basically take all the complexity and simplify it into a beautiful, comprehensible, easy-to-grasp system. I think that's exactly what they want to do. And I think, you know, Steve Jobs and the formation of Apple is a very interesting case because one of the great things that we saw with that is that here were two guys in their garage and they did it for themselves. They formed the world's greatest computer company by themselves in their garage without being in universities, without the endorsement of, you know, big foundations. And I think one of the hallmarks of the post-Enlightenment era is, in fact, that we see people doing things for themselves a whole lot more. So, for instance, you know, 400 years ago, most people couldn't read and write. Mm. Today, anyone with a laptop can write and publish their own book. 200 years ago, most people would never hear a violin play. Now you can download samples from the London Philharmonic, and you can write your own symphony. And we see this as a hallmark of our age, people getting in there and doing things for themselves. And my question here, is there a limit? I mean, are there certain things that ought to be off bounds in this DIY ethos that we've come to so value?
But you also remind us, Margaret, if I may, you remind us through Richard Dawkins why people would not want to respect the limit. I mean, science, talk about Steve Jobs, Enrique raises him, science has its satisfactions that everybody would want a piece of. Dawkins writing, you're quoting him here, science leading to a feeling of awed wonder, delivering, quoting Dawkins through you again here, one of the highest experiences of which the human psyche is capable. It's a deep aesthetic passion to rank with the finest that music and poetry can deliver. It is truly one of the things that makes life worth living. Wow, if that's what science, you know, doing science delivers, you can see why every man would want a piece of that.
Exactly, and I think that's what these outsiders feel, is that they too believe that science can deliver feelings and experiences of awe and majesty and power and wonder, and they want to be a part of that. They agree with Dawkins, but they feel that when they read about the science, particularly the theoretical physics theories in books and magazines, they don't feel it's beautiful and awesome and inspiring. They feel it's bamboozling and alienating and, frankly, a cacophony, not a symphony. And so they're saying, look, we can reinvent this beautiful field in a way that's accessible to every man. And so in a way, it is the great claim of our era. It can be accessible to all. But the problem is, if you've got these sort of, as it were, relatively simple and maybe very beautiful theories, do they actually work? Do they produce the microchips and the lasers and the semiconductors and the high-temperature superconductors that we're all beginning to rely on for these very advanced technologies?
Maybe there's a front-room, back-room difference here. I mean, maybe we need a sort of Steve Jobs version for the world, because it's a lot to ask human beings to wander around with a sense that they can never understand their own cosmos, and only a few can. I mean, even if the details are like some high sacred text kind of beyond some people, there ought to be a version to grab onto. Mindy in Afton, Virginia, you're on the air with Margaret Wertheim, Mindy.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think Carl Sagan would be excited to hear this conversation. I think, though, that it doesn't just apply to science and these scientists who are essentially forming their own communities of learning and alternative structures. I think there are many people who are highly intelligent and who read popular science and who find a lackluster sort of disingenuity with the system itself. And Why not create an alternative system, if you can, if you will, of people that have a pure heart for the science, or whether it be art communities or naturalist communities.
It's tricky business, because you can end up who knows where. On the other hand, if the system, as you say, Mindy, is slippery, or a slippery pole, hard to get up, hard to get into, higher ed, I can see that. Appreciate that. Tom in Fairleigh, Vermont. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I would just like to mention to your you and your guests that some of the mainstream science actually blocks development, and that the developments go past just the possibilities of being interesting or entertaining for people. For instance, cold fusion had been widely debunked, and yet a few people continued to do experiments where they got empirical results which defied the current theories. Most of the theoreticians denied these things because they preferred their theories over reality. An example of the practical consequences of this are that just 2 days ago in Italy, a gentleman named Andrea Rossi demonstrated a 1 megawatt generation plant that ran for 6 hours with no external source of energy, and he is selling them now. Online, people who want to look up what is now called LENR, for low energy nuclear reactions, will find a huge body of empirical work by both backyard scientists and also mainstream, very well trained and highly credentialed people who indicate that this phenomenon is real.
Tom, let me take that to Margaret, if I may. How about it, Margaret? Not only do we have your fringe at work, but mainstream science standing in the way of something out there?
Well, the gentleman's referring to a very controversial aspect of physics. It's called cold fusion. Mm-hmm. And it was a phenomena that was discovered, in theory, about 18 years ago, I think it was 1993, by two American scientists, Pons and Fleischmann, who claimed that they had got nuclear fusion happening basically on a beaker on a desktop. Instead of using a big, some sort of an accelerator, they'd managed to achieve nuclear fusion, like the kind of fusion that's going on in the sun, on a desktop. Now, if this, it was huge international news,
sure.
Every paper wrote about it. If this was true, it would mean we would have, you know, just the absolute desirable source of energy, would solve all of our energy problems. Scientists, mainstream scientists, very quickly repeated Pons and Fleischmann's experiments and weren't able to verify them. And so the mainstream scientific community came to the conclusion that actually there wasn't fusion going on in a beaker.
But Tom, our caller wants to know if in general you think orthodox science may be standing in the way of something out there.
Well, what's happened with cold fusion is that there's this huge international community of fringe people investigating it, and they have their own meetings and they have journals. And at least one of them has now claimed that he's actually succeeded in having a full-on 1 megawatt generator from cold fusion. So in this particular case, the cold fusion community, who are generally outside the mainstream physics community, they believe that the mainstream physicists are actually blocking this important research, and they're continuing to do it on their own.
Margaret, you've opened such a great window for us. We've just got a minute more. Tell us about Jim Carter. Is he still at it out there? He says gravity's not the result of things falling down, but of the earth falling up. Is he still at it out in his trailer court in Washington?
Jim is still at it. He's still making giant smoke rings. He's still filling in the details of his theory. He believes he's explained what we now call dark energy, and that his theory has got a better explanation for this major cosmological phenomena, which many mainstream scientists would like to find the answer to.
You light the impulse up for us, Margaret, and I'm sorry that we're out of time, but that's just terrific. I mean, it makes us think about mainstream science as well in a big way. The new book is Physics on the Fringe. Margaret Wertheim in Pasadena, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. It's been a delight.
When we come back, how the hippies saved physics. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother gives.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Some of the big ideas in modern physics can sound pretty out there. Turns out, there may be a reason. some of the cornerstones of quantum mechanics, quantum entanglement, and what scientists call spooky action at a distance, come out of the work of some freewheeling hippie physicists in the 1970s. They took ideas from quite far-flung sources, from ESP to Eastern mysticism, and brought them into mainstream science. MIT physicist and science historian David Kaiser tells that story in his new book, How the Hippies Saved Physics, Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. David Kaiser, thanks so much for being with us.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what happened here? Your cover's got somebody naked doing upside-down yoga on the cover and thinking great things.
Well, that's right. I always have to remind my more obnoxious friends, that's not the author photo
okay,
on the cover.
Okay, fine.
It's a splashy image.
Looking good. Yeah. What happened?
So the book looks at, again, a very curious episode in our recent history, and mostly the 1970s. We might call it the long 1970s. When physics as a whole, especially in this country, but in fact all over the place, was going through a really quite dramatic transition, the profession, the discipline, the professionals. And make a long story short, there was a great confluence of factors, a huge series of budget cuts, a very rapid disappearance of jobs for professional physicists.
What, because the crunch. Sputnik challenge was over? The Cold War didn't need as many physicists all of a sudden?
It was all those sorts of things. That's right. So and stoking that, of course, as well, was the real heating up of the anti-Vietnam War protests on campus. It was a genuine moment for reassessment. What's the place of the Pentagon in higher education on American campuses?
So you had physicists, trained physicists, who were out of job or maybe just out of sync with the mainstream all of a sudden.
I think it was both. That's right. So the folks I wound up focusing on had PhDs from some of the nation's most elite programs in physics. These were extremely well-trained people, very smart, very eager, very passionate. And most of them had the misfortune of graduating with their PhDs just as that bottom fell out.
Of the job market,
the funding and the demand and all that. Mm-hmm. And so as I trace in the book, through sort of one way or another, they kind of bumble along in the early 1970s and they made their way to Berkeley, California. I mean, I always joke.
Of course.
What else would you do, right?
Right.
If you're out of work in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And there their paths converged. They found each other again through sort of accidents of history that one person knew another. They introduced, they meet at these other strange places. In
they found each other. They also found, as you write, a culture, a very distinctive kind of focus and culture.
That's right. And I think that's what was so so really striking for me is that these folks were, out on their own. They had exquisite training. They really knew how to calculate. They had a great love for the equations of quantum mechanics, for example, and Einstein's relativity, and great skill with them. And they also were, you know, not they were carving out what I sometimes call a kind of parallel universe for themselves. So they had to find their own ways to facilitate their research, since they weren't for the most part in the mainstream universities by that point. Mm-hmm. They had to find their own patrons. How do you pay for this stuff? Right? Mm-hmm. It's a non-trivial topic. They had to find their own, we might say, communication outlets, and they got very creative with that, partly modeling on and sort of taking part with the kind of counterculture underground press, mimeographs and postage stamp. And so they had to spread the word, and then they basically found new and kind of creative ways to pursue these really big questions that had gotten them into physics in the first place.
But those ways were colored by that very counterculture that surrounded them. What was it that caught their eye and the counterculture kind of bled through them into physics?
That's right. And so it matters that they were well-trained. It also matters, as you say, that they were sitting not just anywhere, but in fact in the San Francisco Bay Area during this real kind of efflorescence, a blossoming of what we would now call the kind of counterculture as it bleeds into a new age phenomenon. That was going on throughout the United States and around the world, but at its most intense, at its most extreme and often earliest forms, at least in the U.S., in the San Francisco area where these folks were. And so
people were talking about kind of spooky, undefined kinds of power. Or ESP, like the, I don't know, bending spoons at a distance.
All of that stuff. That's right. So there was what we might now call sort of the occult or mystical or New Age, mind reading, for some people an interest in UFOs, for others an interest in tarot cards, and clairvoyance, and as you say, psychokinesis, using the powers of mind. Sometimes that went under the rubric, the sort of nature of consciousness, which is a fairly innocuous term. It could cover lots of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, again, if we put our minds back to, you know, San Francisco in the early 70s, this was front page news not only in the underground kind of tabloids of the counterculture like the Oracle from Haight-Ashbury,
right,
but in fact in the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco Examiner, that there were front page articles on tests at very well-established laboratories of mind reading.
So how did these talented physicists in that culture where did their exploration take them that came back around, in your framing, to actually save physics? Yeah. What do you mean?
Well, I should be clear. I hope it's clear in the book itself. The title is, of course, meant to be a bit playful and
yes, but still, they brought something that ended up being part of a very important advances in physics itself.
They certainly did.
What was that?
So I wanted to write the book because there were, in fact, as surprising as it might sound, a series of very specific contributions of lasting value that we now teach to our students. We write it in our textbooks. They really came out of this kind of very unusual heady brew. Most important, it had to do with a topic. It now goes by the name of Bell's theorem. It's named mm-hmm. for a remarkably talented physicist, an Irish physicist, made most of his career at CERN in Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote this, at the time, very obscure paper in the mid-1960s, got very little attention at the time. And nowadays is at the forefront. And the group that I wrote about became what we might call the early adopters. They latched onto that topic long before it was common.
And what is it? To explain it, if you can, to us, Bell's theorem.
Sure. So John Bell formalized, he codified what some of the earliest architects of quantum theory had suspected and argued about and weren't quite sure about, going back to the age of Albert Einstein, mm-hmm. Niels Bohr, Erwin Schrödinger.
Mm-hmm.
And Bell in a remarkably elegant paper, demonstrated that if what we know about quantum theory is true, then quantum theory must include some very strange effects, even stranger than the ones that the other folks had already talked about, Schrödinger's mm-hmm. cat and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant, according to Bell's analysis, that two objects, two particles, say, that had interacted at one point will retain a kind of connection with each other. It starts sounding actually kind of like telepathy, that mm-hmm. one will somehow know what the other's doing, even if they are arbitrarily far apart.
Spooky action at a distance is where we start to go here.
That's right.
A scientific term, it turns out.
So Albert Einstein is the one who introduced that mm-hmm. term. He thought it was not meant to be a term of praise. Einstein mm-hmm. hated this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
One more reason why he thought quantum theory was off the rails.
Mm-hmm.
And it was well after Einstein's critiques that Bell came along and said, well, you know, quantum theory has this as a necessary feature. It's not just a possibility, but quantum theory as we understand it. This must be a property of the world if everything mm-hmm. else we know about quantum theory holds. And that is, you might imagine, the kind of big, juicy, metaphysical, what does it all mean kind of question that these folks about whom I wrote were hungry for. That's what got them into physics in the first place. They hadn't seen that covered in their mainstream curricula during the kind of Sputnik boom years.
So did they step in from the kind of counterculture hippie realm and prove it out?
Some of them did. So, in fact, one central member of this group, they called themselves, by the way, the Fundamental Physics Group. They spelled physics with an F. They were very playful,
cool,
very joyful. And one member, John Clauser, who was at that point a postdoctoral fellow at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, a very elite national laboratory mm-hmm. in Berkeley. And he was basically, as we now know, coming to the end of his sort of mainstream career in physics. He never got a mainstream job after that. He's now rumored to be in the running for the Nobel Prize. Okay, he's already won a string of and well-deserved and very mm-hmm. prestigious prizes mm-hmm. in the recent past. So John is a remarkably gifted experimental physicist. Mm-hmm. Most of the others were theorists.
Mm-hmm.
John, with a grad student at Berkeley, conducted the world's first test, the first laboratory test of this so-called spooky action distance that, in fact, John Clauser had hoped, he mm-hmm. said, to prove quantum mechanics wrong. He thought, like Einstein, he thought this was a horrible idea. But it required a kind of careful, controlled laboratory test. John recalls he could find no physicists, virtually none in the mainstream, who found the topic worthy of attention.
But he was open to it in part because of this very kind of hippie culture that he was moving.
He found this group of you know, equally passionate, mm-hmm. kind of out of the mainstream physicists, mm-hmm. and he said that's the only place, that was the only show in town. Mm-hmm. That was where one could go mm-hmm. to talk about Bell's theory.
They were just open enough and crazy enough to think about it.
That's right. And as you know, as John has described it to me, he thought of the group as something like the popular show these days, Mythbusters. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
said, you know, why? Again, these even woolier phenomena like mind reading, like spoon bending, mm-hmm. like, you know, all these other, we might now say, occult things, they were getting, you know, tremendous attention, at least in the Bay Area in that time period. And he said, if there's something to that, you know, then shouldn't the tools of science be adequate to the task, right? I mean, these are mm-hmm. smart people, other smart people
Let's
with
check
PhDs,
it out.
Mm-hmm. making these, claiming there are laboratory replications and so on. And so Clauser himself was, I think, never a kind of true believer, but interested enough to say, we're awash in this. What's going on? science, physics is powerful enough, we should be able to either debunk it or find an explanation.
So what was proved out of this that leaves you thinking now, all these years later, 2011, that maybe Bell deserves a Nobel Prize? What firm or now accepted thing we might not have found otherwise was affirmed, confirmed by this woolly, wide-open perspective?
So one thing is indeed just the fact that Bell's theorem really does seem to be true of the world, not just true of our equations. Bell showed that with great elegance, but true of the world. And in the wake of John Clowes's path-breaking experiment, there have now been dozens and dozens.
Is this quantum entanglement?
This is exactly quantum entanglement. Mm-hmm. That's right. And that is, as I say, sort of page one of most of our textbooks now. Why is that? Because it's at the forefront of this whole blossoming area called quantum information science. That includes things like quantum computing, quantum encryption, which is now moving from sort of scratch pads to beta tests to real-world demonstrations.
What's the real-world demonstration? I mean, I still need a cell phone to call my kids. Why can't I just telepath to them?
Well, that's right. So I should say, one of the outcomes—
they only text anyway.
They're going to text you back anyway. One of the things that this group found was that Bell's theorem was really juicy. And if Bell's theorem was true, where else might it lead? What are the limits? What are the implications? Where might it fall apart? How does it sit with Einstein's relativity, which is not at all clear on first viewing? And so so this group either themselves were the first to prove in some instances, or in other instances were the first to kind of provoke a few other, we might say, more mainstream physicists into demonstrating the ultimate compatibility of quantum entanglement, Bell's theorem, with mm-hmm. Einstein's relativity. No one knew that before. Bell mm-hmm. didn't know that before. Mm-hmm. In fact, even Bell laced his famous article with hints saying there's something strange going on here about instantaneous effects that sits ill with our other understanding of space and time.
So has this moved all the way into applications, or was it the satisfaction of proving it out that they accomplished that is the landmark?
I think it's both. And so for them at the time, most of them really were after this kind of satisfaction. They were deeply passionate about the science, and they wanted to pursue it sort of any which way they could. Some of them began designing sort of thought experiment devices. One even began filing for a patent in the late 70s mm-hmm. for a device that actually he thought might at the time have been able to harness entanglement, Bell's theorem, to send signals faster than light so that your children could text you before mm-hmm. you'd receive their text before they sent it.
Okay.
It gets woolly very fast.
Okay.
The ultimate unjammable, untappable mm-hmm. kind of communication mm-hmm. system. And indeed, it was in designing those kind of increasingly, Rube Goldberg designs that a kind of cat and mouse game unfolded between these very, very smart, engaged, and a bit out of left field physicists about whom I wrote, mm-hmm. and a few other physicists a bit more centrally located who also began to share the same interest in Bell's theorem.
How much of their stuff turned out to be bunk? How much of it turned out to be core?
A whole bunch of it turned out to be bunk, but really productive bunk. I mean, most physicists make mistakes most of the time.
Sure.
Mainstream ones too. And what's amazing, and what I really enjoyed when I realized there was maybe a book here, was that a lot of their mistakes were non-trivial, physicists would say. So in elucidating why these things broke down, the entire community learned lots of new things that no mm-hmm. one had known, and now literally are step one for our textbook. So, for example, now we can do quantum encryption because we learned a new facet of quantum mechanics that no one had known before. It's now called the no-cloning theorem. It's akin to the kind of uncertainty principle. It's not quite the same.
Okay.
And that was demonstrated or derived three different times independently of each other, all in response to the thought experiments by this group. We know that now because of the provocations of this group, and that's exactly why things like quantum encryption can unfold.
David Kaiser's new book is How the Hippies Saved Physics, Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. Let's get a call from Stanton, Virginia. Mary's calling. Hi, Mary. You're on the air with David Kaiser.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is, is the phenomenon of physicists in the 60s quite comparable to folks that were kind of thought to be out there throughout history coming up with some of our most core scientific beliefs, really in every field from, physics to mathematics to medicine? And I'll hang up and let you answer that. Thanks.
Mary, that's a great question. David, was it ever thus? Do our big breakthroughs always come from people who at the time people think are a little wacky, a little out there.
I don't know if it's a rule of nature that it always happens that way, but the caller's quite right. We have, I think, a long list of examples of questions that had seemed either childish at the time or indeed, you know, or foolish, that were deeper questions than people first gave them credit for. And that it, and what I, again, what I liked about this group and what I really gravitated toward is that they weren't only out there on their own. They were remarkably well-trained.
They'd done the work. They had the discipline under their feet.
That's right. So it wasn't just reclining naked in the hot tub, so there wasn't. In fact, plenty of that. Yeah. That was part of it for them. But it was also, at the same time, very hard calculating and trying to prove, in some sense, to some members of the mainstream's own satisfaction, the points they're trying to make. And it's that it's the discipline combined with the creativity, the questions people aren't otherwise asking. I think that is what made such a potent mixture.
You're at MIT. What could we learn from them today as we pursue science and new frontiers?
You know, I think, again, part of it, to, just to continue on that last thought, is that we really do need to do the hard work, to have the discipline, and to do your problem sets. It's hard. It can seem, as the last guest was saying, it can often seem very foreign and like a foreign language. But there is, I think,
but then get in the hot tub too. Then free your mind up a little bit too. On top of that,
I'd say at the very least, if there's a way to cultivate a kind of maybe a skeptical openness to questions that might on the face of it seem absurd, because those do have a tendency over history to surprise us. That's right.
Keep an almost childish sense of play alongside that tremendous discipline that science requires.
That's right.
David Kaiser's new book is How the Hippies Saved Physics, Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. He's head of the Science, Technology, and Society Program at MIT. David Kaiser, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure for me as well. Thanks.
Listeners, we'll go out with a little more from the time the Grateful Dead's Dark Star. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.